The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week, I talked about, gave a talk in response to what was happening in Japan, what is happening in Japan. And I thought that I would say just a few words today and give a chance for us as a community or as individuals to speak a little bit about our response, our thoughts, our feelings about what's going on. It has a big impact on many people. And one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to make space to identify, to acknowledge, to name, to see what's actually happening for us as it's happening. And one of the tricks in doing such a thing is not to get into the problem-solving mode or the blaming mode or the anger mode, blaming someone else, but to really stay present for what's actually happening for us immediately for ourselves. And you could ask, which is fair, I think, how's that going to help anybody? You know, just stay, isn't that selfish, just to focus on how it is for me? I should, you know, we should be focusing on solving the problem out there and not focusing on myself. I think one of the principles of Buddhism is that if you're going to leap, you should first crouch. You can't leap, you know, standing on your tippy toes, you can't leap very far. But if you really want to jump, you bend down, and then you can get some spring in then and make a good long jump. If you want to be able to leap out into the world and support the world and make a difference in the world, it's best if you first crouch or bend down or get centered or grounded in yourself first and really find out what's going on here, so that we're not surprised when we finally leap to have this discovered that we were actually standing on our tippy toes. And why isn't the leap, why isn't the jumping working? Why is nothing happening? And so one of the things is, you know, function of mindfulness is to do this kind of checking in and connecting in some deep way to ourselves. And that process also is connecting to our hearts. And so that it's hard sometimes to be connected to our hearts in a deep way. And to have the ability to connect to our hearts and to work through all the barriers that can exist, all the fear and anger and greed and stuff, that confusion that can keep from our hearts operating beautifully. So part of the function of this kind of bending down, crouching, is to really bend, settle into our hearts and then let the heartfelt response have a chance to come forth. There's a story, kind of a myth in Buddhism about Avalokiteshvara, the great bodhisattva of compassion. And the story goes that she, she went and was helping someone. Her job is to, she goes around and helps people. She's full of compassion. And so she helped someone and was happy with doing that piece of help. And then somehow she lifted up her head from that particular situation, looked out and saw that there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands more people in the same position who needed help. And so she realized, you know, how can I help all these people? One story is that she started crying because, you know, it's one thing to help this one individual, but these hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are in the same position, how do I help them all? So the myth goes that she then sprouted 1,000 hands, arms, and each hand had an eye, and each hand holds an implement. And so the idea being that she has all these eyes so she can better see all the suffering of the world, and all these hands to better support, help in the suffering of the world, and all these different implements, because everything needs a different tool in order to help different people in different situations. And so as I think about this myth, this image, I think that Avalokiteshvara is all of us. When we come together, and when there's some way in which we come together as a single body, as a community, that then we have 1,000 arms and 1,000 eyes and 1,000 hands, and then we can see much more broadly what's going on, and we have many different tools and implements in which to act in the world. And I think forming organizations like the Insight World Aid or Bhikkhu Bodhi formed the Buddhist Global Relief. They function as ways in which a community of practitioners, community of people, can combine their efforts and interests and love and labor and finances as a way of reaching out in a way into the wider world that it's hard for individuals to do. So together we create the bodhisattva of compassion. Together we create a beautiful collective response to what goes on. For us as the insight movement here in the West, we're still babies, but maybe not babies anymore. I think maybe we've reached adolescence. I hope. On the brink, getting close, getting ready for adulthood. And maybe it's kind of disappointing for you to hear that I think we're not quite adults yet as a community. But we're working at it, and we're working at it quite quickly. And so as we enter into the kind of an adult stage of our community, or the insight communities in the West, part of that involves taking our place in society, not just being practitioners for ourselves, which is a profound thing to do, but also at some point have done enough practice, enough transformation, enough healing, and that then we kind of begin taking a place at the table of our society and in our world, and so that we can participate in an active way with what goes on in our world. And there's many levels of that, but I think there's a kind of thing that the Insight World Aid will do, and there's a kind of thing that the retreat center we're doing is creating, that's also creating a kind of a way of being responsive to the world. And there's many, many ways of responding and being part of our society. So I think if we're working, building, and going in that direction. I know some of people, or maybe some of you, have been impatient and thinking that we should be much further ahead than we actually are. Why aren't the Buddhists doing more? Why aren't they more involved? And you have to give us time to grow up. And if we grow up well, then maybe we can, you know, be responsible adults in our community. But if we rush it too much, then I don't think we'll do the proper, lay the proper foundation that's needed for the kind of, I think that for that role that I hope that we'll have as we come along here. So what are your thoughts? It's a big thing, this thing that's happened in Japan. And it's reached our shores, both by sea and by air. So what are your thoughts? What would you like? Anybody want to share or say something or bring something up?
I like to think we're precocious, if not adults. I guess the danger is to spread our efforts ineffectively or point our efforts ineffectively. We see all these well-intentioned and probably do good work, Bhikkhu Bodhi and other individuals. And maybe that's the path that is appropriate where small organizations find what moves them, focuses on those things and makes a difference in that scope. So I guess the question is, the grand scheme of things, like to save all beings, big scope, realistic scope is what can we do? What can we realistically do? How do we assess a situation that we can impact given the resources that we have or the growing resources we might have?
Yes, it's excellent questions. And so if we have enough eyes and enough people involved, hopefully we keep asking those questions and do the research and the work. I mean, the world is full of examples of well-intentioned people who created more damage than good, going into communities where they thought they knew what was needed and they go and do something which maybe was disrupted the community in some way. So hopefully we do things. That's one of the reasons to do things slowly and carefully. Like this thing that going to Cambodia. We're not rushing to Cambodia tomorrow. Jeff went there a couple of months ago and did a um, kind of scoped it out, kind of just what was on the ground, what's going on there, and talked to the people we know in Cambodia, like Beth Goldring and other people, and kind of got a lay of the land. And he's planning to go back again end of the year or next year in order to do another round of that. So there's a lot of, for that's an example, where there's a lot of care is going into it. Whether there's enough care, I don't know. You know, who knows? What can an individual do? I think we can do more as a group, but one individual can do a lot of things. I wouldn't underestimate the value of one person or any one of your efforts. If you get focused and concentrated, a concentrated person can do a lot. So I don't know. Yes.
I hope I don't start crying. I've actually felt really overwhelmed this week. It's just heartbreaking, really. I feel my heart is breaking. And it's such a big example of the suffering that I know is happening in all of our lives, more or less. And I've had all these really unconscious responses, like my husband and I have been eating Japanese food all week. And I've been going to the Japanese markets and talking to in Berkeley, and so many people have family, and everyone wants to talk about finding a brother-in-law who was just found after 4 days. And tonight we're having a lot of our kids for dinner, and I'm making a big Japanese meal. You know, Gary's giving vacation time up at work because the counties are actually offering their employees give up vacation time and we'll send it to Japan, and that's Alameda County. So it's, on an emotional level, I feel like during the day, just these waves of profound, not really anxiety, although this is finally the time I've made our earthquake kit. It's really, I find I wanted to ask you today, you know, how to work with sort of this sort of rising deep sorrow that comes up, and I feel it all over my body.
Mm-hmm. So. You started off by saying your heart's broken. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, what's really important for you in having a broken heart? Why is that important?
Well, I don't know if it's important. I just feel it is. It's like I'm acknowledging sort of how connected I really feel to so many people.
So the broken heart teaches you that connection in a way.
Yeah, it really is another real deep experience of that connection that I feel with a place I've never been, you know. I've never been to Japan.
And that's phenomenal, to feel that connection and to feel it in the broken heart. What falls into a broken heart? You know, there's a beautiful story, if many of you heard, because I like it so much, of this yeshiva, that story that had a sign on the wall that said, this is in a school, it's a sign on the wall, and it said, in this school, we place the teachings on your heart. And there's some student asked, well, you know, why do you put it on our hearts? Shouldn't you put it in our hearts? And the teacher said, no, only God can put it in your hearts. We put it on your hearts so when your hearts break, they fall in. And so one of the, you know, something's important to break, have your heart broken, or really feel in some deep way what goes on in the world, because then there's energy there to respond or to do something. To go back to business as usual and close up, I think, is a kind of violence to ourselves. One of the things I'm reflecting on, you know, is in Japan, is it's tragic what's happening in Japan. And now that over 10,000, 14,000 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands of people homeless. And so it goes on and on, the story there. But it's gotten our attention in a way that other places in the world haven't, when there's been 100,000 people killed by ethnic violence or something, and so somehow we feel closer to what's going on there with the media or the news, or all those images are kind of much more in the forefront. And you know, it shouldn't be a surprise that this stuff happens. This stuff's happening all the time, and so to have our heart broken, not to be despair, but to be energized that we live in a world where it's really important that we prepare ourselves, or we train ourselves, or we practice some deep way so that we can be responders, we can act in this world. Because it, you know, so next time we're not surprised and frozen up, but we come out and act.
Something that's of great concern to me in the idea of reaching out in the world is really coming from that place of the love, and because fear and anger are naturally something that will arise in response to some of these kinds of tragedies. And I think it's really problematic when people are acting from the fear or the anger rather than from the love. So that's something for me that is important.
Yeah, that's why we have to crouch first. That's why we bend down. That's, you know, sit and meditate. And the bending down is the way that we work with our fear and anxiety, and so that it doesn't have, that it's not in the forefront and doesn't keep us limited. And when we work through that, then we're ready to leap. Behind you.
I was at my Rotary Club this Wednesday, and we had the district governor for 5150, my region, there, and he spoke about Japan and the Japanese relief effort. And I don't know if you know what Rotary is, but it's a community service organization of professionals, and it's around the world in every, almost every country on the globe. And he pointed out something that was really comforting to me, which I actually, being a Rotarian for over 20 years, already knew, but it's nice to be reminded. And we took a donation up for Japanese Relief Fund, and he said that we have 350,000 professional volunteers around the world in Rotary, and every dollar that we donate will actually go to relief. It isn't siphoned off in bureaucracies or corruption or whatever. And so that made me feel much better.
350,000 arms and legs and eyes. It's pretty good for Avalokiteshvara.
And if you want to make a donation through the Rotary Foundation, just Google it online. So it's just Google Rotary Foundation, and that's the international branch of Rotary. And I'm sure that you can search on Japanese Relief Fund if you want to donate to that particular endeavor.
I think on a personal level, what I've been noticing is a sort of the conflict that's arising, or where to put your attention, where to put your motivation, there's all these different components. There's the IRC event. There's the Japan crisis. There's Libya. There's all these really significant events that you just, if you're slightly awake, you walk around and it just comes through. And I think what you're pointing to, Gil, is our practice, you know, doing the practice, sitting, crouching, learning to notice our hearts contract when we become frightened, when we become overwhelmed, emotionally sad, hearts, you know, softening. How do we respond appropriately to at all? As you know, here I am, this person. How big can I stretch my heart? And just sort of noticing that, just sort of watching that, is part of what my practice is these days. Mm-hmm.
That's great. I mean, watching the mindfulness, I think, is so important because it'll show us when we're off, hopefully. So, if we can get off by being spread too thin and trying to do too many things. And there's something to be said about even doing one thing really well. And, you know, some people have something they're connected to, and to really, they can take that one thing and go really far and make a big difference in the world. So mindfulness teaches us, I think, when we start getting off and start getting fragmented, and that's not useful. And so then hopefully by paying attention to what's actually going on in us, we can make the course correction and realize, you know, I'm doing too much. I need to kind of do less. I need to be more focused on one thing or two things or a few things rather than doing all this. And then also just to realize that it's infinite, the number of causes you can be involved in. And so there has to be some choice, and not to feel, not to succumb to, some people have succumbed to a kind of sense of moral obligation, that we're obligated to respond to everything. We have a duty or something. And that also stretches us thin. One of the teachings of the Buddha was when he was asked where to give, where to be generous, whether it's with your money or with your labor, your efforts, or anything. He said to give where it makes you happy. And I think that's a very interesting koan, very interesting kind of reference point for giving, or so being of service and helping the world. To give some place that inspires you or is meaningful for you or uplifting for you or kind of that partly it's uplifting or meaningful, it brings you happiness because it fits with who you are. I can imagine that, just to make it up, that maybe you're in the music business and that's your love. And so what you can do for Japan is you can gather up musical instruments that extra people don't need anymore or whatever and send it to the communities where the kids who are musicians have lost all their instruments. 450,000 people have lost their homes and homeless. How many kids who are, you know, who were really into music and inspired music and they need schools again, they need all this different stuff. And so you might think, well, musical instruments, that's a small thing when people are, you know, starving and homeless but it is a small thing at the moment, but maybe it's a big thing and make a huge difference in some people's lives down into the future. But for you, if you're a musician, that's what inspires you. That's what you can do. That's the part of the world you're connected to. It brings you joy and happiness. I can do this part, and someone else can do the other part. But this is what inspires me and brings me joy. So I think there's kind of a looking at what fits for an individual, for each individual person. And as I said last week, it isn't just a matter of responding directly to everything in the world. You can't. But I think we can be energized by everything, be motivated to make a difference in the world by it. And so it might be that instead of helping in Japan because of all this, maybe your response is to somehow respond locally more fully. Maybe you're already involved in the volunteer work someplace locally. And so maybe you're going to try harder there. Or maybe when your work, whatever your work might be, maybe there's an opportunity there to make a difference with how you do your work, how you support and help your neighbors or your someone. And so you're going to make more efforts there to make a difference. And how Japan has affected you is giving you more impetus to do that. So I think everyone has to make choices. And depending on their circumstances, their life, their situation, we make different circumstances. But different doors are open for us for different people. And not all people, you know, I hope that... That, you know, Avalokiteshvara has 1,000 hands, but each hand has a different different implement. So each of us is our own implement, and so each of us can have a different way.
I would echo that with some comments from a friend of mine who's reporting on the ground in Japan right now, who says that the relief efforts are great, but at a certain point, it's a wealthy culture, and that many of our efforts might be better devoted elsewhere from this point forward. And I think in any charity situation, it's important to be not just motivated by the right feelings, but also very selfless and very mindful of what the needs are.
Right.
And to listen carefully to the other so that it's not just about our own sense of feeling and we're doing good, but being very skillful in the good we're doing and where we're applying it. Mm-hmm. So I very much appreciate the group you're starting, that it is being very deliberate, which is not my own personal sensibility. Because I think that'll help focus efforts where they have the most leverage and can do the most good.
Yeah. In the back.
I'm of a certain age where I participated in the 1970s activities of the Physicians for Social Responsibility that gathered around the issues of nuclear armament and the idea of mutually assured destruction. And I noticed their organization popped up in the news here recently. Reflecting on the process of what that was like, there was an arc of about 6 years, and the beginning of it, the crouching, was a very painful education, and a broken heart was the perfect starting place as one started to learn about what had happened in Japan as a result of the nuclear weapons. The arc lasted about 6 years, and at the end of that, things politically started to change. And for myself and maybe for the group, we went through that whole 6 years never thinking that it would work. There was a constant set of disbelief that was sustained only by the gathering of that group of people to keep it going. So at the end of 6 years or so, when it finally started to wind down, it was like, oh gosh, did we have something to do with that? That's so cool. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody on this side who want to speak?
You alluded the other, I'm kind of coming off of what he said, you alluded the other night to the idea of getting angry. And I found that that was something that definitely happened for me because I was part of a group that did a lot of marching and a lot of demonstrating about the 500,000 years it takes for plutonium to become safe. And the nuclear power plants are just not an option, was basically what we were thinking. And so there's self-righteousness, there's anger. How can we still let this happen? And anyway, so what to do with that? Because it comes and goes during this time.
What to do with anger?
Yeah, self-righteousness and anger. Not self. It's not exactly self-righteousness. It's like, how long can this stuff keep going on when we know it's impossible for nuclear power to be safe?
So a few things about anger. One thing very interesting about anger is that anger is often connected to people's power and strength. When people get really get angry, there's just energy, there's power. And I think it's beautiful that people are powerful, that people can engage and have energy. And so one of the things to respect about anger is the power that's there, the energy there, is the motivation that's there. And in fact, some people want to justify anger because of how it's energizing and motivating. It gets people to get things done. What I'd like to see is, I'd like to see the water thrown out, but the baby kept. And so so keep the energy and the motivation to do something, but transform the anger into ferocious compassion. Because anger has hostility as part of it. And so we want to free ourselves from the hostility, but we don't necessarily want to free ourselves from really powerful, strong compassion. And so I think part of the function of mindfulness practice is to be able to be present enough in ourselves to be attentive to the details of what goes on inside our hearts, to be able to tease apart and see the difference between ferocious compassion and hostile anger. And to be very careful about acting from hostile anger, because that probably will go awry. And I think compassion can be at least as motivating and as strong a force in the world as anger can be. And so seeing the problem of nuclear energy and that it might be there, to act out of the compassion and concern rather than anger. And my own belief is that if you act out of compassion, then it's more like we're coming from being empowered. If you come out of anger, I think we've already been disempowered. That's part of the reason why people get angry, is they feel like they have no power. They feel they have no hope or possibility. And I hope that Buddhism teaches people is not to be self-limited, But to, if they identify with anything, it's who they are. To identify with their ability to act and respond rather than to be limited and inhibited or held back. In this regard, it's interesting that if you look at the stories of many of the mature practitioners in Buddhism, great teachers and all that, they seemingly all had great love for others. Maybe there's a need to love, but they had no need to be loved. To identify with our capacity to love, to love others, identify with that, more than identify with a need we might feel to be loved. So to identify more with our capacity to respond and go forward and do something in the world, rather than identify with how we're limited and hurt and our life now is difficult. So I think if we identify with the right thing, then I think it's more likely we can come from compassion.
One thing though, I mean, it's not the danger that might be there, it's the danger that is there, and it's not a maybe. I mean, we know we don't know what to do with this waste.
Yeah, I know.
Long term. And I mean really long term. Anyway, I understand what you're saying. I know anger is not going to cut it in many, many ways.
I think also, this is going to be a strange statement, I suppose. I think that it really helps in knowing how to respond to the world or being able to respond to the world and to act in the world. If a person has really worked through their fear of their own death, and if you're still afraid of your own death, then these things are like salt in your wound. But if you've really looked death in the face and no longer afraid of it, then there's a whole different way in which we tend to respond.
I spent quite a bit of time in Japan in the mid-90s. I was over there during business, sales and service of manufacturing equipment, and was struck by how our culture and the Japanese cultures are on the opposite sides of a neutral point in terms of courtesy and order. So I spent a memorable week and a half there with the customer from Texas trying to negotiate the final specifications on equipment, and realized that to directly say no to a request is very rude in that culture, that there was great importance on not causing people to feel uncomfortable. And I was listening on the radio that the people near the reactor zones are expressing doubt in the assurances that they're receiving on the safety of the situation. But it's very hard in that culture to come out and say, I don't believe you. And it's very painful for them. Certainly in the area of whose fault it was, that would just not be an appropriate question there. Here, we love that. That's kind of the first thing that we go to. So it can be hard there to accept the reality of a situation because of this tremendous desire for order and courtesy. And I think this is causing the Japanese to come to terms with that and maybe to rethink that. And we could certainly learn a lot from them as well, being on the opposite side of that divide.
Thank you. So one more person, and then we'd probably stop. I saw, yes.
Yes, that'll be me. Thank you, Gil, for saying that we need to look at our own death acceptance. I think what has hit me about this event is that Japan, I look at Japan as comparable to our society, and certainly in preparedness. And when earthquakes happen in Haiti or other third world countries, I can look at the confusion and the distress and somehow put it in a different category, that Japan has said to me, that could happen here very easily, and we may be next. So that was, I think, the point of recognizing my own death came closer with this event. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to say one other thing about not just aid in this situation, but I had an opportunity to go to a war-torn country 40 years ago and work with starving children and children who had been abandoned because of a war. And it's unbelievable the amount of need that is there to respond to, like in Japan or Haiti. And what I found was the most important thing I could do in my life since then is be attentive to the next thing that is next to me, to the person that is next to me. Because trying to fill a need as great as what we see in the world leaves you very empty.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you. And so, to end, so one of the ways to be energized, one of the ways to act motivated by these things is to also put more effort into your own practice and to be able to clarify your own heart, to go deep inside yourself. And somewhat, we want, hopefully the world needs some people who do the deep inner work of uprooting greed, hate, and delusion, of really see and understand where they come from, what goes on, what motivates them, people who really touch into in a clear and pure way their capacity for love, compassion, freed of greed, hate, and delusion. And it's not an easy thing to do, to get down there and really do that. So I hope that all this encourages you in some ways. Maybe it's the wrong word, encourage you, but fuels you in how important it is for you to do your practice, to do your crouching well. And I'm struck that in the same kind of breath here today, I evoked both the Insight World Aid and our Insight Retreat Center that we're starting. And I'd like to believe the two are connected, that our capacity to create a retreat center that allows us to go deep into the inner world will translate to becoming better capable as a community and as individuals to go deep into the interconnected world of service and helping the world around us. So those of you who are interested in and be part of that discussion with Inez, I guess you in maybe about 10, 15 minutes or so. End of the temple cleaning. I'll start. Meet in here to have the discussion. So thank you all.